Our next speaker brings to our seminary an ironic spirit and a calm, almost monastic. He's our Christian wise man on the hill, exhibiting a Zen-like state of meditation and the equilibrium near Buddhist. While no volcanic geyser, his waters run deep. His opinions are typically well considered, and his arguments demand our attention. If we gravitate towards fields conducive to our character, it should come as no surprise that our contemplative professor studied moral theology at Notre Dame. And while he lived in South Bend and did studies, he served as assistant pastor of Emmaus Lutheran Church, which speaks to his work ethic and dedication to the church. Since coming to the seminary in 2012, he has become our go-to guy, and we can count on him whenever we have questions in ethics, natural law, and philosophy, which admittedly is not all that often, as we usually have no idea what he's talking about. Proof of his prowess can be seen in his dissertation, "Be Transformed by the Renewing of Your Minds, Christian Worship as the Root of Righteousness and Ethical Formation," which has now been approved by Oxford Press, no less, for publication under the slightly more pithy title, "Ethical Formation in Christian Worship, Righteous and Holy in Christ." But you should know there is another side to our speaker. His snappy dress, argyle socks, bow tie, and handkerchief shows that he's no ascetic. And his lovely wife, Regina, the mother of his 8 children, can attest to the fact that he's no monastic. And the fact that he's a Colts fan demonstrates that within his moral theology, there's a healthy place for violence. Perhaps I should tell you that in a previous life, he served as surface warfare officer in the U.S. Navy, where he learned the power of swift and lethal attack, the kind of experience that has surprisingly useful civilian application, especially in faculty meetings. His naval efficiency can best be seen in his administrative work. Since taking over our Doctor of Ministry program, he has not only revamped, but also transformed the program. Always attentive to students, he has brought a moribund program to life, making it attractive and affordable, a real gem in the service of our church. Today, he offers us a paper entitled "Marriage, Divorce, and Remarriage, the Triumph of Culture," and we are sure to be both edified and made to feel uneasy. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in saluting a good friend and colleague Grifford Grobing.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Peter. Barna's most recent extensive survey investigating marriage, conducted in 2007, indicates that about one-third of Americans who have married, about 78% of the total population, have also divorced at least once. This survey became the object of much discussion because it indicated a lack of significant variation between the rate of divorce among non-Christians and the rate among born-again Christians. However, this infatuation with the rate of divorce reveals a somewhat shallow view of marriage held not only by secular society but also by Christians. To chide a person for divorcing assumes that divorce is essentially a choice, which further suggests that marriage is essentially a choice that one can do or cannot do. Marriage, however, is more than this. It is an institution and an order, and divorce is also indicative of an injury against this order. No thinking person simply chooses to get divorced. Divorce, in fact, can be good and proper, and is good and proper if it defends a person from further injury. To get to this, however, we need to analyze more deeply the character of the institution of marriage. And so I want to trace the apparent triumph of the American culture's view of marriage, even within the church, and encourage a restoration of the understanding of marriage, which is biblical and conjugal. This will reveal also how the church can understand divorce. Now, contemporary conventional wisdom views marriage as a relationship of romantic love, including sexual relations, and of mutual support by which a couple shares the responsibilities and rewards of domestic life. Now, usually such a relationship assumes exclusivity, although the recent rise of the popularity of being a swinger suggests that this is also weakening. In any case, the high rates of divorce previously quoted suggest that commitment is a relative term. Commitment may endure only so long as the couple feels affection for each other or senses compatibility in personality or life goals. In modern, recent decades, Christians may view the level or type of commitment as the difference between contemporary secular marriage and Christian marriage. Unbelievers aren't committed to each other the way Christians are. And more recently, as the conventional understanding of marriage has expanded to include any two people, and now in some cases beyond two, regardless of sex, Christians also express the divine definition of God as an important difference. God defines marriage as between one man and one woman. Now, such distinctions are true and important. However, this focus of Christians in the marriage debate camouflages the more fundamental problem among most Christians and churches in America today. While Christians may quibble over the variations on a term or who fits certain categories, they generally agree with the basic secular definition. If you ask a Christian to define marriage, he will typically answer similarly. It's a committed romantic relationship in which people share domestic life. He will probably today include the limitations that it be between a man and a woman, and he will probably argue that commitment takes some work and effort and goes beyond feelings of compatibility. The marriage needs a kind of stick-to-itiveness. But the actual relationship between married partners for both secularists and Christians today is essentially the same, perhaps differing only in degree. This similarity reveals the triumph of secular culture in this area and indicates the fundamental problem in the American church's contemporary ideas about marriage. This contemporary view of marriage, Robert George calls revisionist. In fact, it is a view that differs significantly from a traditional biblical view and even undermines this traditional view. Because of this, when Christians try to tack on elements of biblical marriage, they don't stick. Marriage is between only one man and one woman. Okay, but why? Because the Bible says so. Yes, and that's fine for Christians, but essentially meaningless to a secularist. Commitment should be for life. Well, again, why is this so, and why do we think that this is self-evident? In fact, it's not difficult to make at least a pragmatic argument that commitment need last only as long as the relationship seems mutually beneficial, or as long as we receive joy and pleasure from one another, sort of along the lines of a contract. Rather, to counter the revisionist view of marriage, the church needs to reflect more deeply on the essence of marriage and restore its traditional articulation of marriage as a fundamentally conjugal relationship, that is, one oriented around male-female sexual relations and the family that is established thereby. In fact, this conjugal view of marriage is implicitly supported by sociological research. So I want to take a little bit of time to review some of this sociological data. And we may discover, in fact, that the triumph of culture is not so thorough. Family research, broadly speaking, among sociologists, defines itself not only in relation to marriage, but also in relation to the bearing and rearing of children. Critics may protest that this vestigial orientation towards child rearing is due to the influence of religion and tradition. However, family research acknowledges that children are produced in domestic romantic relationships and become an important part of domestic life. Children are the acknowledged most important resource created in marriage. While laws, social expectations, and community processes regarding marriage affect childbearing even to this day. As such, families may be defined behaviorally by co-residence and by childbearing, whether inside or outside of marriage. Formally, co-residence and childbearing, while defining behavioral characteristics of a family, differ from marriage because marriage is defined in part by laws. As families formed outside of marriage grow in number, policymakers and individuals try to formalize aspects of non-marital family relationships, such as when the father of a child born outside of marriage is formally identified as that child's father through the establishment of a legal paternity. Clearly, the connection between marriage and family has become much looser, and marriage is no longer definitive of family. Yet one cannot help but note that the institutionalization which revisionists hope to accomplish with new law is accomplished by marriage itself. Marriage has become passé and restrictive, yet it actually does what is sought by co-residence and childbearing, that is, support a mutual domestic relationship and family. Even revisionists see this as important. Yet social expectations and laws have become more tolerant of divorce and of children out of wedlock, so that marriage is tied less to childbearing and establishing a family, and the permanence of marriage is also declining. In fact, we can see this gradual dissolution of marriage spanning the better part of a century and indicated in two distinct trends. It's not just going back to the 60s. In the early 20th century, couples began to view marriage not merely as the foundational institution for familial relationships and the raising of children, but also as special companionship by which satisfied emotional and romantic needs. Spouses were supposed to be each other's companions, friends, and lovers, to an extent not imagined by the spouses in the institutional marriages of the previous era. The emotional satisfaction of the spouses became an important criterion for marital success. As a result, the importance of marriage in the minds of young people increased, so that 95% of young people in the United States married by the 1950s, about 5% more than married in the early part of the century. Young people also married younger than at the beginning of the century, age 23 for men, down from 26, and 20 for women, down from 22. As is widely known, the birth rate also increased, leading to the baby boom. After this time, however, laws regarding divorce began to change to eliminate fault or legal punishments in most divorces, weakening the legal institutionalization of marriage. This occurred with the second transition in marriage, which came to full expression toward the end of the 20th century, in which young people began to view marriage as a unique relationship for individual expression and fulfillment. Developing out of the earlier transition to emotional satisfaction, married persons began to focus more on personal satisfaction in general, and the self. They began to think more in terms of the development of their own sense of self and the expression of their feelings, as opposed to the satisfaction they gained through building a family and playing the roles of spouse and parent. Personal development, rather than mutual sacrifice, the malleability of roles and communication, which would confront and address problems, rose to characterize beliefs about marriage by the end of the 20th century. That is, kind of tactics to keep your marriage healthy, good communication, rather than talking more fundamentally about love and self-giving and self-sacrifice. The individualization of marriage could be characterized as an intimate partnership entered into for its own sake, which lasts only as long as both partners are satisfied with the rewards, mostly intimacy and love, that they get from it. These transitions in the social understanding of marriage have attenuated the central place of marriage in the contemporary social context. Society accepts more forms of so-called marriage and other alternative relationships so that intimacy, sexual relations, and even the raising of children need no longer occur within the social institution of marriage. Much of the decline in marriage since the mid-1960s is matched with a rise in cohabitation. Even while individuals accept the decline of marriage, they still sought the companionship and structure of marriage-like relationships, such as in cohabitation. For example, cohabiting women's sexual behavior, such as the frequency of sexual relations and the use of birth control, is closer to that of married women than to single women. Cohabitors see living together as an opportunity to assess compatibility, while fewer see marriage as a defining characteristic of their lives. Although individuals at first see cohabitation as an alternative to the companionship of marriage, socially, the difference, although moderate, persists. Cohabitation dissolves more quickly and more frequently than marriage due to the persistent legal and social institutionalization of marriage. Marriages are more difficult to dissolve also because of the pooling of resources and mutual investments, such as children, a pooling which occurs to a lesser extent among the cohabiting. The pooling of investments retains for marriage another importance. and economic importance. In the place of a committed companionship which supports family life, marriage is seen as an economic relationship by which pooling economic resources gives partners advantages economically. If one spouse loses his job, the other's job mitigates the loss of income. Pooling incomes, a home, and other significant property is more attainable. Yet at the same time, economic uncertainty and the fear of the loss of economic independence may hinder or delay marriage. Cohabitation requires fewer upfront economic achievements. While marrying couples feel the need to reach certain economic goals, such as a house, secure career, or a minimum level of income to support a family. While only 33% of women marry by age 24 in a 2007 study, 60% of women cohabit by that age. Cohabitation offers many of the same benefits of marriage and has begun to substitute for early marriage. Cohabitation then might be considered a viable pathway out of singlehood for young adults. That is, depending on a person's situation, cohabitation may serve as a mediating step between singleness and marriage, or it may serve as an alternative to marriage. As a moderating or mediating relationship, cohabitation contributes to, but is only one factor in the delays in age of marriage and of childbearing. Recall that the rewards sought in revisionist marriage and marriage-like relationships have changed from those oriented around social expectations about family stability and the proper raising of children to those fulfilling personal needs. In this sense, marriage retains value among many as a relationship of status and recognition. Marriage makes the statement that the partners have passed a milestone in the development of their self-identities and have reached a comfortable, stable, if still progressing moderately, stage in life. Marriage is now typically a sign of maturity, not a relationship to enter into when one is merely entering adulthood. Thus, the elevation of the average age of marriage since the 1960s is affected not only by economic factors, but by these psychological ones. Marriages are delayed until couples have reached a psychological or emotional maturity. This research suggests that marriage has not been completely deinstitutionalized and remains valued, but that other priorities have shifted the place of marriage. Significantly, young American adults' desire to avoid mistakes in marriage, or marriages characterized by abuse, discord, or marriages which end in divorce. Love and companionship are still of central importance, but these can be found and experienced in other contexts or relationships, such as cohabitation. Marriage is reserved no longer even for companionship and romance, but simply for the psychologically and economically mature and established person. This more recent understanding of marriage as the capstone of adulthood is illustrated in the difference between the marriage naturalist and the marriage planner. From a sociological perspective, the marriage naturalist is a holdover from a bygone era. He sees marriage as an inevitable and seamless step in life to be entered into as the natural result of a romantic relationship as the couple enters into adulthood, that is, a young age. Full maturity and commitment develop within the marriage relationship, not prior to it. On the other hand, marriage planners prepare for marriage by establishing themselves as adults, educationally, professionally, financially, and mentally, prior to considering and entering into marriage. Even once maturity and independence have been reached, they then need to achieve a level of commitment with their partner before marrying. For planners, commitment must be achieved by gaining intimate knowledge of one's partner, experiencing decisions and setbacks together, learning to communicate, developing a sense of mutual trust, and believing that their relationship has a kind of inevitability. That is, that they are the right person for one another. This can take years or decades to figure out. For the marriage naturalist, commitment isn't achieved, as it were. It happens when the couple marries and lives each day in view of this established, committed relationship. The naturalist perspective is nourished in locations with a lower cost of living and in economies in which a moderate education provides a comfortable earning potential, such as rural areas. On the other hand, a post-industrial economy with a high cost of living and the need for high levels of education and work experience to achieve financial self-sufficiency encourages the perspective of the marriage planner. From this, we see that both psychological and economic factors drive one's perspective on marriage. The researchers who have put forth this bilateral model of marriage naturalist and marriage planner claim that marriage has not been deinstitutionalized, just reinstitutionalized. Their data does indicate that marriage is no longer connected strongly to childbearing and living together. In fact, the acceptability of these practices outside of marriage has shifted the place of marriage from a central life institution to one of a capstone relationship. The marriage planner marries only after he has established himself as an adult. Before he reaches this stage, he may easily cohabit one or more times. Data on increased rates of childlessness since the 1960s also give us insight into the changed perspectives on marriage. These increased rates of childlessness are associated with individualism and freedom of choice. That is simply a perspective which views childbearing, even within the context of active sexual life, as something to control and choose rather than something to receive as a fruit and blessing from God in a sexual relationship. The exercise of this choice is linked to other changes, including fertility control, contraceptive technology, female work preferences and patterns, and sexual and family norms. The equalization between the sexes of opportunities for non-familial roles presents the opportunity for this freedom of choice, especially among women. The changing place of marriage in public opinion in the 20th century is interwoven with the rise of cohabitation, as indicated. Exploring the intricacies of the causality between the changing face of marriage and the rise of cohabitation is beyond the scope of this presentation, although the data we have briefly reviewed suggests that the general rise in cohabitation followed on the shift of marriage, that understanding of marriage, from a domestic institution oriented around raising children to that of a unique companionship which satisfied emotional and romantic needs, with the accompanying relaxation of divorce laws and social stigmas against cohabitation. Generally speaking, decisions about family are influenced by trends toward greater individual autonomy, which is also supported by features of modern economics, the push toward sexual equality, developments in fertility control, and the changing psychology of maturity. Cohabitation is now an important opportunity for many people to experience romantic companionship and to test the waters for marriage. Again, to summarize, the three main reasons for cohabitation could be summarized as to provide some economic support while also allowing for a quick exit without economic ties to a partner, to seek gender equality through psychological and occupational maturity with the resulting avoidance of stereotyped gender roles, and as a trial period for determining how well the partnership serves individual fulfillment. Now, because of the significant role played by cohabitation, many sociologists and policymakers suggest further institutionalizing cohabitation with legal protections. This would serve to reduce its instable nature and to support couples who are cohabiting. Cohabitation has little to no official legal recognition in the United States, although cohabiting partners may support their relationship legally through individual contracts, such as sharing property rights, establishing lines of inheritance, and sharing power of attorney. Health and social insurance claims would require legislation. Now, in all of this, although children are seen as central to family study, as we noted at the beginning, very little has been said about children. And admittedly, that's part of those are the studies I looked at. I didn't look at a lot of the study on children, but I simply want to point out that in the studies I looked at, advocates of legislation to further institutionalize cohabitation tend to assume that the well-being of children of cohabiting parents can be managed positively. It is interesting to note that cohabiting couples who conceive are more likely to marry than those who do not, while having children reduces the chance that cohabiting couples will break up even if they do not marry. In having children, therefore, couples recognize the importance of commitment. They see children as somehow bonding that relationship in some way. And for many of these, they see it as having its best expression in marriage. So I hope that by now some of you have become to detect the loose irony of this contemporary status of cohabitation and marriage. Right? Some fear or determine that marriage has become deinstitutionalized or that its status as an institution has changed. In its place have arisen different ways of experiencing and expressing romantic companionship and domestic relationships. Promoters of cohabitation, or at least those who see it as part of society here to stay, have suggested that legislation be developed to further and formally institutionalize cohabitation. Those who cohabitate are in need of legal support, just like married couples, to make the sharing of assets, benefits, and children easier and legally defendable. But the irony and the point, right, is, of course, is that we already have the kind of legal support for those things that cohabiting couples are seeking, right? And it occurs in marriage. I mean, that's what marriage is the legal support for these kinds of needs. So somehow, in the convoluted development of marriage over the last century, marriage has been adjusted, rejected, renamed, or marginalized. And yet what society generally wants and needs is marriage. That is, a romantic companionship that is legally recognized and defined in order to support domestic life. They may call it something else, such as cohabitation or domestic partnership. But this is, in fact, fundamentally a reaching for, a striving for marriage. So long as it is truly sexual, that is, male-female, when we recognize that the general natural expression of domestic life includes the bearing and raising of children under normal circumstances, we have in its basic form the biblical traditional conjugal view of marriage. So to briefly expand upon this conjugal understanding, as a sexual union, marriage is a unique union. Again, Robert George, he points out that it is the only union which is a truly organic or biological union. Nearly all biological or fleshly acts can be accomplished by one independent body, respiration, circulation, digestion, and so forth. In fact, fleshly union with respect to any of these acts is impossible. Only in sexual relations, or what he calls coitus, and he uses that term in particular for a reason we'll see in just a moment, do two bodies act for one biological function, and that is the function of procreation. Coitus brings together two bodies in a fleshly union to make possible the singular biological act of procreation. So any bodily touching that is not coitus, even touching that is of a sexual nature, is not true bodily union, but only juxtaposition or a kind of contiguousness, even if this juxtaposition happens to occur inside a person's body. One might argue that non-coital sexual relations nourish and express intimacy and emotional union. Okay, but such a union would be just that, one of emotion, the will, or the mind. It is still not truly a fleshly union, a bodily union by which two bodies act together as one body with an organic or biological purpose. The fleshly union of man and woman is fundamentally a bodily union, but it also includes the union of other human qualities such as the will, the emotions, and the mind. In sexual relations, a man and a woman would also properly coordinate their wills, emotions, and minds. Indeed, their souls are coordinated and caught up with one another in the purposes of deepening and nourishing their relationship, of enjoying one another, and of conceiving, bearing, and raising a child. And so in this sense, marriage is not just mating. The relational bond is as much a part of the fleshly union as the biological union. Coitus is not the only element of marriage, yet it is the fundamental, unique element of marriage. To insist upon the biological or organic union as fundamental to marriage does not in any way marginalize the other ways that a husband and wife are united in marriage. Nor does the fundamental character of fleshly union in marriage in any way diminish or annul the marriages of infertile couples. The union of flesh refers to the act of coitus. In coitus, man and woman come together as one organically. Should this act not later result in conception, says nothing about the act of union itself. Whether a couple achieves bodily union depends on facts about what is happening between their bodies, not other factors regarding the effectiveness of the reproductive system. And so it is, in fact, only through fleshly union that two people can be completely united. People of all sorts may be united emotionally according to their wills or according to their minds. Co-workers unite to find a solution to a research question or a mechanical problem. They have a union of intellect. Friends are united in common activities according to their wills and often according to their emotions. Bodily union, however, occurs only between two who engage in a union of the flesh. And so the only relationship that allows the full union of persons, bodily, emotionally, according to the will, and according to the mind, is the relationship which includes fleshly union, that is, marriage. St. Paul's words in Ephesians 5 express the character of this fleshly union, a union of love, of care, of growth, and of nourishment. This, then, is the conjugal view of marriage, the permanent and exclusive relationship of a man and a woman expressed in conjugal acts, which acts also presume the conception of children. As such, marriage is oriented toward raising children. The descriptors permanent and exclusive are fundamental both because the greatest companionship should be that which has no end, and because the raising of children requires the enduring commitment of the parents. In both cases, permanency becomes a basis for trust. With a confidence that his spouse will not leave the marriage, a husband or wife lives in the intimate, trusting confidence to be self-giving both to his spouse and to his children. Note here, then, the fundamental differences. Revisionist marriage is for romantic enjoyment and self-fulfillment. Conjugal marriage is to be united, to grow in unity, not only a unity of bodies, but a unity of true love through a self-giving which expresses and confirms trust in the other, but is grounded in the biological union. Marriage, then, is no mere choice, but it is a new way of living. Marriage is a divine order of life by which God naturally provides companionship for individuals and by which He himself continues to bring forth new natural life, to educate children and provide for them. Romance is a good and blessed quality of marriage, which grows out of the conjugal relationship and commitment, and ought to be nourished by the husband and wife. But it is not definitive of marriage. Marriage is much more than a choice, because the presumption is that most will marry. Consider Luther's discussion of the sixth commandment, and I quote, "Marriage is a necessary walk of life. It is solemnly commanded by God that in general both men and women of all walks of life who have been created for it shall be found in this walk of life. To be sure, there are some, albeit rare exceptions, whom God has especially exempted, and that some are unsuited for married life or others God has released by a high supernatural gift, so that they can maintain chastity outside of marriage. Where nature functions as God implanted it, however, it is not possible to remain chaste outside of marriage. For flesh and blood remain flesh and blood, and natural inclinations and stimulations proceed unrestrained and unimpeded, as everyone observes and experiences. Therefore, to make it easier for people to avoid unchastity in some measure, God has established marriage, so that all may have their allotted portion and be satisfied with it," unquote. Where nature functions, he says, it is not possible to remain chaste outside of marriage. It's not a choice. Our earlier brief sociological survey confirms Luther's words. While the perceived burdens of marriage have been rejected by society, the desire for companionship remains. And not only does marriage remain, but also other relationships which seek after this kind of companionship and self-fulfillment, the kind of exercise of one's passions, which Luther's referring to. Society cannot surpass the natural inclination to sexual relations, and it struggles to find ways to enjoy these relations. But all along, marriage has stood as God's gift for the expression of sexual relations and the relationship, indeed the intimate union of bodies, that is inherent with sexual relations. When marriage remains in the realm of mere choice, it becomes one other option, to choose or not to choose, to enjoy once I am mature or not, or to cap my entrance into and success in adulthood, or to make my life better economically. But except for those who have been given the gift of celibacy, marriage is not a choice. It is a relationship into which we are called. Choice certainly plays a role, to some extent, in leading to whom we may marry and when we marry, and to be sure we choose every day to love and serve our spouses. Yet fundamental to these choices is God's calling of us into this natural and blessed institution. So then, when we understand and teach marriage rightly, the teachings on divorce become clear. Just as those without the gift of celibacy do not have the choice not to marry, so we do not have the choice, strictly speaking, to divorce. Divorce is not a choice of one or both spouses, but it is a recognition of the brokenness of the marriage. There are reasons for divorce, real reasons, reasons which ought to be upheld and defended, so that our injured brothers and sisters be defended as well. Reasons like sexual infidelity, abuse, abandonment. When there is no repentance or the breach of trust is irreconcilable in these cases, the marriage has been broken. There is divorce. Divorce exists not from the beginning, but because of our hardness of heart. And precisely because our hardness of heart remains until the resurrection, divorce also remains until the resurrection. And it ought to remain, but specifically for the sake, love, and defense of the one sinned against, not simply as a choice to move in and out of the most convenient or enjoyable relationship. Divorce protects Christians. It does not stigmatize them. Divorce renews the opportunity for married life for the Christian. Thus, in a simple sense, neither marriage nor divorce are choices but come upon us. The former is given as a great gift to be embraced by God, and the latter is the protection and renewal of Christians who have been sinned against in marriage. And this is how the church should view and practice marriage, to teach and model marriage as a conjugal relationship, a permanent and exclusive union which God establishes and grants to teach us how to love and to raise up the next generation in fear of him. It is not mere romance, but a solemn order, not to be tweaked or revised or renamed, even in the face of secular challenges. The church, again, to teach and model the good things and fruits of marriage, of which romantic pleasure is only one part and not the greatest part. To teach and model that in the bond of marriage, husbands and wives learn true love in giving of themselves to their spouses. Notice what I said this here very specifically. To teach and model that in the bond of marriage, husbands and wives learn true love. You learn it in marriage. It's not something you have to accomplish before you marry. It's something that you learn in marriage. To learn true love is to empty oneself for the sake of another. A person learns to mature by living in marriage, supported by family and the church. This is not the self-fulfillment of secular society, and the sooner children learn this, the sooner they will be on their way to embracing conjugal marriage. As they learn these truths of marriage, they will be ready to marry as they approach adulthood, not waiting to attain some unattainable level of maturity at age 30 or 40, a maturity that may never really come because the individual has not given himself over to love one another. And indeed, finally, conjugal marriage is true self-fulfillment. It is the union not only of feelings and will, but of flesh. It is a union and fulfillment deeper, more complex, and more mystical than the romance of secularism. It is an expression of true permanent love, the love which Christ shows and expresses towards his church. Out of such love comes new life, and out of such love comes the inexpressible joy of true fellowship. This is the love, joy, and fulfillment which culture longs for, which they have ironically abandoned in marriage, even while stumbling out to embrace it again. For decades, the church has followed the culture. Now, once again, in marriage, the church should be the church, to be a light for the culture, whether those of the culture come to the light or not. Is this a retreat, a separation, or a flight from culture? not when we have the courage to teach and practice what culture truly longs for. Thank you.
Now you know why we're so glad that he's here. And there's time now for questions if you'd like to come approach the mic and
Paul Herder, Hope Adrian. One of the congregations in the Michigan district of the LCMS determined within the congregational leadership that in view of the attempts to bring about legalization of gay marriage within Michigan, a case which now apparently is going before the Supreme Court, that congregation would no longer perform governmental marriages. We have a insight on that. Have you heard of this before? Do you have a suggestion as to?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for the question.
Sure.
I mean, I think this is an issue that we need to respond to thoughtfully. Because on the one hand, as a church, again, we don't want to abandon marriage. But again, here's what I would say very briefly. If we understand again the three divine orders, right, of the church, of marriage and family, and then of the government, the political realm, each of these are established, so to speak, out of the natural law by God. The government doesn't define marriage. I mean, marriage stands as its own institution. But nevertheless, the government does have authority to oversee, to regulate, to acknowledge, to certify marriage, whatever we want to call it. And so as Christians, we ought to do that. We ought to seek that. Even when the government begins to define marriage improperly, we should still, who marry properly, seek that recognition by the government. Now, I think so just to clarify, whatever we do, I don't think that Christians should sort of abandon government marriage altogether. Now, but the other question, which is what you're, the main thing you're asking, is should pastors actually perform government marriages? And this is an issue, actually, that we're discussing on our faculty. There's publications that are beginning to write about it. My personal opinion is that if pastors are going to become co-opted by the state, so in other words, if the government comes in and says, okay, well, you've agreed to do state marriages, so you need to marry anybody we tell you to marry, then I think at that point a pastor has to say, well, no, I'm not going to. And I think it's not a problem if a pastor no longer sort of participates in that kind of thing. I mean, a church, you can have a ceremony before a judge that's the state marriage, and then you can have a blessing in the church. And that's how it's, you know, obviously that's how it was done in Germany, and Luther's time is still done in Germany and is done in many countries. So
I think part of the fear involved there is to have a gay couple come into your church and
right.
insist that you have to do this or we're going to sue you or whatever. So.
And there,
which,
I think there,
you know, I don't know that it's happened in a church, but certainly there are examples of that happening to Christians in our nation,
right.
Where they've been involved in different businesses that have catered to
right.
married couples and have been sued by gay couples claiming to be discriminated against.
Right, and I think there are other policies that congregations can put into place to help safeguard against these kinds of things. I mean, you can't always predict what's going to happen, and you can't sort of legally protect everything perfectly. But, you know, for example, things like, I don't want to suggest this necessarily as a policy for everybody, but things like, you know, marrying only members or only members of the Missouri Synod or churches you're in fellowship with or things like that. But those are things that congregations should talk about. And
yeah. Eric Anderson, Summit and Hodgkins. In light of since it's impossible to remain chaste outside of marriage, how early do you think Christian marriage could or should take place?
Well, the most obvious restriction would be puberty, first of all. There are some cultures that marry before puberty, right? So just to make sure I'm answering the question thoroughly, right? So, if we're going to have a conjugal view of marriage, then I think they ought to be at puberty, right, at least. I think there's a lot of freedom, and I think this is, again, where the divine orders are helpful, because this is why we have parents, this is why we have pastors, this is why we have brothers and sisters in the church, to help bring along young people and help them to kind of envision and imagine what marriage should be like and to move toward that, right? We should always be educating our children towards that, giving them that good kind of imagination, so that as they, after they hit puberty and after they're growing in their teenage years and early adulthood, they already have this perspective and they're starting to make good choices about these kinds of things. So, if you're asking, does a person need to be self-sufficient? I don't think so necessarily. There's nothing wrong with parents supporting young people who get married, financially.
Right, yeah. I've often in my confirmation classes suggested that the marriage age is way too late and encouraged them to think about getting married younger.
Yeah.
Of course, with great fear of being called up by the parents.
Yeah. Well, I think a key to all of this is that we have to also expand our vision beyond the nuclear family, right? Because if I say, you two 16-year-olds, you should go get married, and you think, and then they're starting to have children every 2 years, and they're all on their own, right? I mean, that shows a complete lack of care on the part of the extended family, and perhaps to some extent on the part of the church. And
yeah,
so
this is a challenge that married seminarians often face with children.
Yeah, exactly. And so we need, as part of this, we need to remember that, family doesn't end with the mother, father, and children. That's why we have grandparents. That's why we have aunts and uncles. That's why we have cousins. And we support each other, and we help each other out. Same thing with college. If somebody's going to college but also is ready to marry, you don't have to stop helping them with, if as a parent, you've said, yeah, I'm gonna pay for your college, or I'm gonna help you pay part of your college, and then the child says, oh, well, you know what, I'm gonna get married. You don't just only say, oh, well, I'm not gonna help you anymore, right? That's not a good reason to stop helping. So.
Ben Mays, CPH. I have a comment and a question. The comment is about Luther's statement about how it's impossible to live outside of marriage chastely, and therefore everyone should marry. There, he does limit that argument, because for married people, for example, if a spouse falls ill for years and years and years, Luther in his various writings does not allow that the other spouse, the healthy spouse, to divorce and remarry, and says, no, you have to remain chaste, and the Holy Spirit will help you.
Yeah.
So I think whenever we read these statements about Luther saying it's impossible to be chaste outside of marriage, that's not saying, like, as soon as you feel sexual desires, you have to get married right away. So that's, I think, important to keep in mind. The other one is, you had mentioned about the legitimate reasons for divorce, and you just mentioned abuse as one of them and went by it. And I wanted to probe that a little bit more, because I've not found Luther saying that abuse is a legitimate reason for divorce, although I do know that other Lutherans would allow separation from bed and board in order to prevent the greater evil or harm to the abused spouse. Mm-hmm. So I just wondered if you'd looked into that or wanted to say
anything
more about
it. Thanks for your question and your comment. In regards to your comment, in fact, I would certainly agree and affirm that heartily. And it actually goes back to the previous question. Just because a 13-year-old now suddenly is starting to have sexual urges, that doesn't mean necessarily that he should run out and get married right away, right? Chastity is a virtue to be practiced, and even sometimes in marriage. And so part of that has to do with our moral formation as well. And so, yeah, it's good to recognize that Luther is speaking broadly and generally and sort of over the course of a lifetime. Yeah. With regard to your second question, yeah, I don't know that Luther has. I mean, you're right. I've never come across Luther saying that either. I think, and you're right. I mean, it does sort of open up a can of worms because abuse can be defined in many different ways. So that would be a topic for another paper. But I would just briefly say, I suppose that, I mean, at some point, abuse becomes abuse is real abuse. It's chronic and it's hurtful, and it's essentially a violation of the fifth commandment. Okay, so I'm not talking about like maybe an incident where somebody loses his temper and just kind of yells for a minute and then kind of walks away and regathers. And, you know, that's not that might be abuse, but it's something that can be reconciled, right? So, but I'm talking about chronic, a kind of a chronic situation where there's really that breach of trust has been broken. And it's really kind of this violation of the fifth commandment that in our fallen hardness of heart is no longer reconcilable. So that's where I'm coming from. And I think you can look at Ephesians 5. I mean, if you're looking kind of for biblical discussion of this, the way that no man overhates his own flesh, but if a man is denying the love for his spouse, denying a love for his flesh, then he's broken the marriage. That may be innovative, but I'm those are my thoughts on it. So yeah.
Okay. So, Jonathan Nauman here. Since every occurrence of the phrase hardness of heart in the Bible refers to unbelievers, how can we tell church members, well, your divorce is permitted on the basis of hardness of heart?
Well, again, I also said that divorce is there to defend Christians who are sinned against. I mean, anybody who... I mean, somebody who kind of instigates or causes a divorce, I would say, is not a Christian, because I mean, I know that maybe is strong language, but hear me out, or at least they're not acting in a Christian-like way at that time, because they have to, because divorce has to do with irreconcilability, right? They're persisting in a sin, right? There's a persistence in a sin. There's a persistence in an irreconciliation. There's a persistence in a case where that's, you know, the marriage has essentially been broken. So, I mean, if it's too strong to say that they're not a Christian, then we would say they're not acting as a Christian.
Last question. We'll keep it short.
Okay. Last question. That's it.
That's it. All right. I'll talk to you outside.
Okay.